extra, extra read the Lost about Titans. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you once again for joining us on Titans Extra. Today, myself, Kelly, and Dylan continue our seemingly endless trek through the deep recesses, the backwaters, the murky depths of 1981 US territories. We'll be looking at Southwest Championship Wrestling, Southeast Championship Wrestling, and finally, Dick the Bruiser's WWA promotion from out of Indianapolis.
Do you want to have a look at Southwest?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you've been watching quite a bit of it lately, haven't you? Probably or some of it more than I have. So yeah.
Yeah. As you know, I've been watching lots of Dory Funk Jr. in various different areas and different promotions. He, as a former NWA champ, in demand everywhere, as it were. And Southwest is actually quite an interesting promotion. Now, before I say anything else, do you two have any, like Dylan, do you have any notes, comments you want to make?
Not up front. Not up front. You take it away, and I'll feed off of you.
Okay. So, well, I mean, yeah. A little bit of context here. Joe Blanchard was the promoter, and somehow he was able to wrangle through various connections a TV slot. In fact, a TV slot which got quite a lot of eyes in front of it. In fact, he was one of the very first promoters. It was one of the very first promotions to get what you'd call national TV. Obviously, Georgia had the had the cable, but I can't remember. Was it USA? I want to say it was USA.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so Blanchard somehow got a USA slot. I don't know about you guys, but you look at the names who worked there in 1981, you think, hold on now, Southwest, this roster looks stacked for what you'd think of being a fairly minor promotion, right? So he basically got that TV, which was then able to, I guess, attract all sorts of different names. He also, believe it or not, had Colonel Buck Robley booking for him at some point in 1981, and he was able to call in a lot of favors, according to him, like Dickie Slater, you know, the Funks, you know, and I guess at that time, wrestling was kind of like, you know, there's no internet, so connections in the business were really important, you know, who calls who, calling up favors. So he was able to get together quite an interesting looking roster for that weekly TV slot that they had. And apparently Blanchard was actually thinking of expanding as early as this, as early as 1981, which I think is really interesting. I've been watching the TV product, and it's got a great, great commentator called Gene Kelly, who's like a real Texan. Like, you can imagine him there chewing his tobacco. You know, he calls Dick Slater Dickie Slater, and it's really fun to see the TV from that time. And there's quite a lot of it which has found its way to YouTube. So there's one guy who's basically uploaded all of it, chopped up into matches, so you don't have any full shows, but you get enough of the angles and things to get a flavor of what this show was like. It feels very regional, even though it was going out on quite a big station. And so let me run down some of the names then. So Nick Bock, and this card, and in fact quite a lot of the cards that we're going to be looking at from here on in, weren't compiled in the same way, so we don't have the stats on the number of shows. Instead, what I did was I went through the entire year's results that we have from Clawmaster and various other sources, and I basically just pulled out who was active, and then I ranked them in terms of, I put the main eventers towards the top, and guys who were there kind of less frequently or, you know, more jobbery towards the bottom. Okay, so Nick Bockwinkel is the first name here, and that's because this was one of the places that Bockwinkel was defending the AWA, and Blanchard had made a deal with Verne that they would recognize Bock as their world champion. So, and as part of that, Bock would come in for the TV, you know, for the additional exposure and defend the title on the TV and at various other shows. I think San Antonio was their, one of their bigger towns they used to run.
Yeah,
it was their biggest town.
Yeah, and they also ran Houston sometimes. Obviously, Watts also ran Houston. Like, I think Watts hadn't taken over. Paul Bosch ran Houston, right? But he yes. did it. He basically did it, as far as I can understand it. He'd make a deal with a particular promotion who would then, you know, book a Houston car with their talent. But then Bosch would come in and basically have the final say on how that Houston show would run, what the finishes would be, because it was his TV show type thing. And he may also bring in talent from elsewhere. It's kind of like a St. Louis deal, but it didn't work in quite the same way, if that makes any sense. Is that right, Dylan? I mean, he basically, somebody would come in and book a Houston card, and then Bosch would basically have the final rule on what that car would look like.
Yeah, they supplied the talent. He would try to run with their storylines and angles as much as he could, but not exclusively. At times they would, you know, my understanding is at times he'd do things a little bit different. And definitely at various points, more so than at others, but definitely it was similar to, you know, St. Louis or Toronto at Maple Leaf Gardens, or even Chicago, really, at the International Amphitheater, the joint shows that, well, basically similar to joint shows that AWA would run, you know, where they were using a lot of Dick the Bruiser's guys. It was along those lines.
So, and at this point, it was mainly Southwest running those Houston shows. So anyway, Bockwinkel, he's artificially there as the top name. So I put him in square brackets. Tully, Blanchard, obviously, big guy in 1981. And, I can talk more about this stuff, but 81 was the year of Tully's heel turn. He'd been a big baby face in that area beforehand. And he ran an angle with the Funks, who were the next two names. Dory and Terry Funk were there quite a bit in 1981. And there's an angle where Tully turns on... Tully basically attacks Terry Funk with a hammer. And as far as I can tell, slices his ear off with the claws of the hammer. So, you know, Terry always did ear injury angles, didn't he? And then he had a big match with Dory for their main title in 81, kind of in revenge for it. And I can't really work out what happened, but there's a big tournament, and Terry ends up coming back off the injury and winning the, you know, their main title in the tournament. Dick Slater was also there. He seemed to be quite a mainstay on the TV that I've seen. Manny Fernandez was there. The Sheik came in for a short run. Gino Hernandez, Tank Patton. Tank Patton was actually one of the bigger heels there that I can tell. Buck Grobley was there, obviously, while he was booking. Of course, he didn't get to go on TV often because everybody in the world didn't want him to go on TV because he would have taken over the world if Buck had had... It's ridiculous. Sorry if I've had that guy talking in my ear for 6 hours. It's a little bit on my mind. Ivan Putski was there. Wahoo McDaniel was there. Chavo was kind of an upper mid-card talent there. Terry Allen, a young Magnum TA, was there. Ray Hernandez, that's a young Hercules, was there. Bobby Duncan, Tom Pritchard. Scott Casey seemed to be getting quite a push from what I saw. So, that's basically the bulk of the mainstays in Southwest in 1981. So with all of that preamble, I think it's Kelly. Kelly, what did you make of this roster?
It's an interesting roster, actually. It's kind of got a bunch of guys from all kinds of different areas, right? You got the Funks, who, yeah, of course, are from Texas, but they're known for Florida and other places. The Sheik, you know, most known in Detroit, Toronto. Tony Atlas, Mr. Wrestling 2. So you got some Georgia guys. Oh, no, sorry, I'm looking at...
sorry, yeah, you have to scroll up a bit, sorry.
I had the page down. Anyway, Wahoo McDaniel, Putski, who I guess had left New York for a bit. Moon Mulligan, there's a name I've never heard before.
Yeah, and I actually saw him. He was tagging with he was tagging with Tank Patton. And, well, I mean, I described him as a 1981 version of Max Payne.
Oh, really? Because I picture him as Moon Mullins, if you know the old... there's a 1920s comic strip where Moon Mullins was like this no good nick that would bum around, bum money off people, and get into trouble and hijinks and stuff. That's how I want to picture Moon Mulligan, anyway.
No, he looks more like a he looks more like a kind of pudgy 300 pounder, something like that.
No, it's an interesting, and it's interesting to hear, you know, that, yeah, they had the TV and they were kind of expanding and bringing in bigger names who wanted exposure. And
yeah, and I mean, I have been reading around this a little bit, and what happened is that Blanchard was actually paying for the TV slot, and it was something like $7,000 a week, and he just couldn't afford to keep up the payments, and he ended up losing the slot. So that's what happened with it. Is that he just
part of, yeah, and part of the story is they ran an angle where they one guy got horse manure poured all over him on TV, and the USA executives didn't like that too much. And then I think Vince came in with like a big time offer for the slot at the same time, something like that.
Yeah,
but so it's an interesting roster. I think it's better than World Class, for sure. Got more star power than Portland and Mid-South, I would say.
We'll just hold off on your rating, Kelly, because I'll bring in Dylan for his comments.
It's a good promotion. I don't buy the argument that they were going to go national. Let me get that out of the way now, because I think that, like, I think it is very easy to say, like, we had national, we were going to go national.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that would like to believe that that was going to happen. And maybe even some of the people involved in the promotion might have thought that, because Terry Funk, you know, somewhat infamously, they got out of Amarillo and they quit promoting because Funk, you know, saw the future and knew that it was cable TV and knew that the territories were not going to last. You know, I mean, that's something that is well documented, not just from Terry, but Terry telling other people during that era who, you know, including some people who were not even wrestlers, who sort of. So as a promotion, I think it's a solid roster. It's a weird roster to me. In some ways, it's thoroughly Texas, right? Like, you know, the Funks. I consider Tully a thoroughly Texas guy from this period, you know?
Yeah, very much so.
Black Gorman is there. Is that Black Gorman? Holy shit.
Yeah.
You know, there's... So, Chavo, I consider a Texas guy. So, it has that, you know, southwestern feel. But... I don't know. I have weird feelings about this promotion. I don't want to say that it is it's not bad, but there's just something about this promotion that keeps me from wanting to this may be just bias. I'm not even sure that this is an objective calculus here. But there's something about me that wants to say, this doesn't rate with what I would identify as a really strong promotion. You know what I mean? Like I but then again, when you look at it and you compare it to Mid-South, I mean, it kind of looks better than Mid-South. On the other hand, we have 50 names from Mid-South. We don't have 50 names from Southwest. So,
right. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I didn't give all of the names, mainly because they're complete jobbers who we, like, literally haven't heard of and probably, like, didn't work that much outside of that area and possibly even that time frame. So, yeah, I just didn't think it was worth listing them, you know.
Sure.
So, yeah, okay. So, Kelly, rating time.
Right. Well, I said, you know, it's better than mid or better than world class for sure, and that was a 4 for me, which my ratings are a bit more generous with some of the territory. I'm not gonna put it on the same level as Mid South and Portland, so I'm gonna say 4.5, in between, I guess, world class and. And I'm pretty positive I haven't seen a match from 1981 Southwest. I'm pretty sure. Maybe I have. Cause I know I've seen Southwest, before, but yeah. So yeah, 4.5.
Yeah, okay. Dylan?
I definitely have seen some 1981 Southwest. I just haven't seen a whole ton of it. I'm gonna say a 5. I'm gonna say a 5, and I have a feeling Parv's gonna go higher than that. Maybe not, but my rationale for being a 5 is, without knowing what the depth is, and operating under the assumption that what Parv just said is true, that everybody else that was there was kind of jobbers. This isn't a deep roster. You know, you can argue that the high end of it is very solid and actually compares favorably to a lot of places, but without that depth, I like to be able to look at the 25th and 30th guy and say, is this a guy that could have been in a meaningful mid-card feud? You know what I mean? Like, is this somebody I could feasibly see in a meaningful, or is this somebody I could feasibly see in a tag team, for example, that would add something to the shows? And like, for example, you see a lot of those guys in, say, Memphis, for example, a lot of those guys in Memphis. I don't see any. Well, I just shouldn't say I don't see any. I don't see – it just doesn't have the depth that I want. So I'm going to have to go 5. Although I could see an argument maybe for as high as 6, but I can't see an argument for any higher than that.
Yeah, I think these are all reasonably fair comments, but I do wonder if you're selling the upper mid-card a little bit short here. Manny Fernandez – Gino Hernandez, Tank Patton, Chavo, all guys who are pretty over in that area. I would say Wahoo, a guy with national name value. Putski, I mean, I don't know how many poles there are in San Antonio. But, I mean, maybe Putski struggled to get over with that crowd. Ray Hernandez and Terry Allen weren't bad young names to have coming through. I'm not going to say the Hercules ever amounted to that much, but he was doing interesting things a couple of years after this, right? So I want to say that, I mean, comparing it to Mid-South, which I've just given a 5, right? Like, literally, we had trouble pairing with Junkyard Dog with people. Let's say Tully is your top, anchor for this promotion. You can have Tully versus Dick Slater. You can have Tully versus Dory. Tully versus Terry. Feasibly, you could have Tully versus Manny Fernandez. You could have Tully versus the Sheik. That's how many. That's a number of
you could have that. That's a fair point. But here's the other side of that coin. Yeah. The other side of that coin is, who on this roster would you even really want as an anchor? In the sense that Tommy Rich was an anchor, or that JYD was an anchor, or that Bob Backlund was an anchor. I don't see anybody on this roster that I would be comfortable putting anywhere close. The thing is JYD is what makes Mid-South what it is. Who is the person in Southwest that makes Southwest what it is? You could argue that Southwest has a stronger, like, top 10 guys, for example, or maybe even top 15 guys. But do they have anybody that's in the same universe as JYD? You know what I mean? Like, that would be, and keep in mind, I'm rating them the same. I see them both about as a 5 level. But
yeah.
JYD to me is like one of the few guys in wrestling in 1980 that has maximum value. He's one of the very few guys in 1980, 81, 82, 83, that the whole really early 80s as a whole, that I look at and I say, this guy has, like, if you were grading the individual wrestlers, he's a 10.
Right.
And I don't think there are very many 10s in wrestling in 1981 in the United States. I'm not even sure you couldn't name 10 of them. You might not even name 5 of them. So
yeah,
that value is huge.
Okay, I mean, just as a basis comparison, I'm just interested. How do you rate Terry Funk or Dory or somebody like that around this time on that same scale?
With somebody like the Funks, I mean, obviously they have value. Obviously they have a lot of value. But they're sort of unique in the sense, especially with Terry, that he never was really anywhere for a long period of time. So you sort of have to take that in mind whenever you're evaluating him. With the exception of All Japan, there's no promotion Terry worked at consistently enough where I feel like he could reach a 10 in terms of value. So to me, Terry's like an 8. When he's around, you know you're going to get a great performer. You know you're going to get a guy who's going to bust his ass to make sure that you have really good quality matches and shows.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that he's a 10 just because he's not around enough. Dory Funk, I see him kind of as a 7. I don't think he's as dynamic a performer. The advantage I think he might have over Terry is that his NWA title run is probably more highly thought of than Terry's was. Sort of a more iconic reign. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that far off in 1981. But I also think by 81, in some ways, the wrestling world was already passing Dory by. But, I mean, he's still a solid 7. I mean, he's still a guy that you can get value out of.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because Dory in 1981 was the Florida champion.
Yep.
He was the, you know, when they brought that title back in All Japan. I can't try and remember the name of it now. It's one of the three Triple Crown titles.
The international title.
Yeah, when they brought the international title back, Dory was the first champ. And, here he is in Southwest as well. So it's interesting the way that different companies used him. Clearly, like, they thought there was some value in him. But, I'd go along with the idea that JYD was more valuable than either of the Funks in 1981, relatively speaking. Any thoughts, Kelly, before we move on?
Well, I mean, it depends how you use the Funks, really. I mean, if the Funks would stay in one promotion for the whole year, I think they'd be really valuable, not only just as performers, but, you know, they have the booking side to them, Dory especially, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. They would be able to help talent develop. They'd probably be able to get talent in. You know, so they'd have a lot of value beyond just performance. So, yeah, I mean, they were still pretty young, relatively young at the time, too. So, yeah, they'd have a lot of value. I don't know about a 10 out of 10, but I think if they were there the whole year, like a 9 would be reasonable, I think.
Okay, well, let's move on to Southeast, shall we? Southeast Championship Wrestling. This is... the Fuller promotion. Oh, did we give our ratings for Southwest? Oh, we should give our ratings for Southwest.
Yeah, I guess we haven't.
I think we did.
Oh, we did. Okay.
Yes.
okay. Southeast Championship Wrestling. Then this is the promotion run by the Fullers. This is Tennessee, is it? Is that where it used to run? Alabama.
Oh God! Mm-hmm. Don't force me to try to explain the history of Southeast.
it's both.
Don't force me to try to explain the history of the Fuller Welch, because this is beyond. Yeah. Like I'm pretty good with 80s wrestling. Well, even a lot of wrestling history, but the back and forth of Southeastern or the Fuller Welch promotions and where they ran at different points always confuses me and hurts my brain. I believe at this point, you know, they were, I think this was, you know, the Alabama, I think they ran Knoxville during this period too, although
Knoxville,
I could be wrong.
Yeah. Knoxville. Right.
Yeah. But I could fill in a bit in. So. I did research piece there just not too long ago. At this time, they were actually both Alabama and Knoxville, but just recently, I think in 1980, they had merged. Originally, Fuller was strictly Knoxville, and then he expanded into Alabama when there was some sort of opening. I believe the previous promoter had wanted to get out. And so, but originally he ran Tennessee and Alabama as separate territories with their own TV, and different talent too, kind of, I think. But by 1980, he'd merged them into one.
I have a real question here. Now, Knoxville, is that a big enough town to run a territory? It seems weird to me. It's like what? I'm just looking it up here. The third largest city in the state of Tennessee.
I'm from East Tennessee originally. I'm from Chattanooga originally, which is about, depending on what part of Chattanooga you're in, about 100 to 125 miles away from Knoxville.
Right.
And Knoxville, the thing about Knoxville is that's where the university is located. That's where the University of Tennessee is located.
Okay.
So it is a sport-obsessed town. I think that's a very fair – I mean, Neyland Stadium is you know, one of the two biggest stadiums in college football, along with the Big House where the University of Michigan plays. And I feel like – to us looking back now, we would look and say, well, Knoxville was not that large of a market. But back then, you didn't necessarily need a super large market as long as you had a dedicated audience that was willing to turn out consistently, you know.
Right.
So because you didn't have to, you know, the thing is, a lot of these promotions we're talking about, including some of the bigger promotions, at least, you know, historically and geographically, these are not promotions that were running 10,000 seat arenas every night. That's a myth. You know, that was not happening. I mean,
right.
Even the WWF and the AWA, which are geographically the largest promotions, you know, in scope and in terms of population that they were servicing, that, you know, some of the, like, in the AWA, they're running Green Bay and Milwaukee, which are 6,000-seat arenas. Now, those aren't small arenas, but that's not what we often would associate with big time wrestling. So
yeah, well, and the WF when you ran those big arenas once a month.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean the AWA ran big arenas too. Don't get me wrong, but the point is that I don't think the size of the market mattered as much at this point. Again, this is very early on in cable television. I think that started to change more and more when cable TV crept in, but obviously for different reasons. But When you were talking about a regional promotion, I don't want to say it didn't matter at all, because I think it mattered in terms of the stars that you could get, which we're about to talk to, right. Or talk about. But I don't think it mattered nearly as much as we would maybe think in a modern, with modern eyes, so to speak.
Okay, my one other, in fact, I have loads of other questions as per usual. But before I run down the roster, did Fuller have heat with Jarrett? Because they were running in the same states?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, I could be wrong on that. My perception was that was a reasonably amicable relationship. I don't remember ever reading any stories. I mean, I could be dead wrong. Do you recall ever reading any stories to the contrary, Kelly?
No, not at all. It seems Knoxville was always considered, you know, off limits to Memphis, you know, the Memphis territory, and that and respected, like you said.
Were they part of the NWA, do we know?
Yes.
Yeah, they I believe they were still at this point. They may have always, in fact, they may have always been a part of the NWA all the way to the very end.
Right.
But they weren't, they were, I don't want to say they were a self-sufficient promotion, because that implies that the other promotions weren't. But I never got the impression, when talking to people who were fans of Southeastern or, you know, people who grew up in East Tennessee during this period, of whom I know many personally, I never got the impression that this company was a company that was terribly concerned with who the NWA champion was.
Right.
I'm not saying that's not the case, you know, and I'm sure there may be a listener who hears this and says that's not true at all, and they very well could be right. But My impression as an outsider is that that wasn't necessarily the case, at least not relative to other promotions that we've discussed.
Okay. Well, they would have had to make do without as many dates, you know, by far as the main
characters.
Sure. NWA would have had
a chance. So, well, I'm just putting it out there now for any eagle-eyed listeners. Just as I group WF as an independent promotion, even though it was part of the NWA, I'm grouping Southeast with, inverted commas, Outlaws, even though it may not have been one. All right, I'll just put that disclaimer out there.
you're gonna piss off Chris Zellner if you keep doing this. You're gonna get some real heat with Chris Zellner. You guys have already got heat for just doing this show. Now you're really pushing the limits here.
Yeah, me and Kelly are becoming the Outlaws, right?
Yeah.
All right, let's run down this roster then. Of course, at the top we've got Bob Armstrong, mainstay for that territory, I believe. Ron Fuller, Jimmy Golden, Charlie Cook, Don Carson, Jerry Roberts, Josh Ludek, Josh Leduc, Ron Bass, Super Pro, who is Randy Rose of original Midnight's fame, Brad Armstrong, pretty young there in 81, I thought, Jerry Stubbs, aka Mr. Olympia. I'm guessing he was just plain old Jerry Stubbs at the start of 81, wasn't he? Mongolian Stomper, Norville Austin, also of original Midnight's fame, Dennis Condrey. Were they working as the Midnights? I wonder.
No.
Ricky Gibson, Robert Gibson, Stan Lane, Paul Orndorff, Ken Lucas, Roy Welsh, Tony Atlas, Mr. Wrestling 2, Les Thornton, an English worker, I believe, and
yep.
Johnny Valiant had a little short run there as well. Cup of coffee. So, Dylan, what do you make of that roster?
I think this is kind of it's an interesting roster. It's not a surprise if you're somebody who's ever looked at a Southeastern card. You know, if you've ever looked at a card that was sort of fell under that banner, or a card that took place in that part of the South that was not run by Jarrett or Georgia Championship Wrestling, almost all these names are names you would expect to be on it. I mean, that's the first thing that stands out. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Stubbs, the Armstrongs, Golden, Fuller. These were people who you absolutely would expect to be on, you know, this roster. I mean, these are the guys that sort of have the name identity with that brand, to the extent that that brand has name identity. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is this is, I think, maybe the, and you guys may not even agree with me on this, but looking at this, I think you could make an argument that this is the roster that, if you look at it, it's probably the roster that looks, of the ones we've talked about, and maybe of the ones we will talk about, it's the roster that looks the best if you don't think about context. Yeah. I'm not saying it looks better than everything else, but like it probably looks deceptively better than it is because of the time period. Because you look at these names and you're like, oh man, there's a lot of really good guys there. But then you think 1981, how much value did Robert Gibson really have in 81? How much value did Stan Lane really have in 81? You know, I mean, it's not that these guys didn't have any value. It's just I think they did. They were not what they were at that point. You know, they're not what we would think of. Of those guys at this point. So I actually think it's still a pretty good roster, to be honest. But I don't think it's an outstanding roster. One thing that's worth noting is the Mongolian Stomper was a really big star in Knoxville. I mean, he's a guy, mm-hmm. Archie Goldie, who's a big star, maybe the biggest star in the history of Stampede, but he was also one of the biggest stars in the history of the Knoxville territory. That's my understanding. I don't know if he's, I don't think he was a Ron Wright, Whitey Caldwell level guy necessarily, in the sense that I don't know that he would be the first person that you would immediately associate with Knoxville if you were an old timer, the way those guys would be. But he's not far off from that level. So he's one of those guys that we look at as a name now and think, well, who gives a shit about the Mongolian Stomper? But to that promotion in 1981, he was probably a pretty significant player.
Yeah, well, you echoed many of the thoughts that I had about this, Dylan, but Kelly, what do you think?
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, these names, we looked at Continental Wrestling on Titans several months ago, and a lot of these names were there in 1986, 85, 86, 87, you know.
And this promotion becomes Continental, right?
Yes. Sorry if that's unclear. Yes, in 1985, in an attempt to sound more, you know, important, they changed their name to Continental, much in the same way that Mid-South changed their name to Universal, the Universal Wrestling Federation, to sound more important with the WWF, you know, encroaching on their territory through TV. So yeah, a lot of these names were still around, you know. They would have been there, you know, throughout the whole period, throughout the whole 80s. Armstrong, Fuller, of course, because it was his territory, Golden, Brad Armstrong, Mr. Olympia. I think he was maybe Mr. Olympia at this time. No, he was definitely Mr. Olympia in Mid-South not too long after this. So. But I don't know too much about Southeastern at all. You know, I researched it for Titans. Outside of that, though, I don't think I've seen any footage from this era. I probably stumbled across it on YouTube or something at some point, but I couldn't really tell you too much. The names, I mean, I think at the time it probably would have been very entertaining TV, I'm assuming, you know, heated angles and then brawls and blood, the Southern style. But yeah, there's some talent here. The Stomper. Yeah, I was going to say outside of Calgary, Knoxville is sort of the only other area where he ever got over, I think, on like a main event level, as far as I know. Gibson, I wonder if was that, were they doing the brothers tag at this time, Ricky and Robert? I don't really.
I assume know. So.
Yeah, I would assume so. Stan Lane would have been just not in the business too long, probably at this point. Josh LaDuc was actually pretty big in the South at this time, so he would have been a significant name. Randy Rose is the Super Pro. I'm guessing that the masked gimmick, the Super Pro, I think was the name of like a video game magazine back in the 80s. but yeah, and then they would have had, you know, guys from Georgia coming in, Mr. SNC, Tony Atlas. So it's not bad. Paul Orndorff. Yeah, it's not a bad little roster. I wish I knew more about it, because I know next to nothing.
What's the Georgia connection here? Because to me, Bob Armstrong's a name I associate with Georgia. You know, Chad always tells me, like, his I think Bob Armstrong was his father's favorite wrestler, and, like, you know, people when he was growing up would always talk about Bob Armstrong in Georgia. What's the deal with him here in Fuller? Is this where he was? Because didn't Bob Armstrong work for that, like, weird little kind of side promotion, like, you know, the Georgia promotion where people
in Macon,
in Macon,
Brad Ward's promotion. See, yeah. Geography dictated a lot in the Southern territory, well, really in every territory. But in these Southern territories, I think maybe more so, you know, you see, like, for example, one of the knocks against the Andersons when it comes to Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame season is that they didn't draw anywhere outside of their home base, but they worked in both Georgia and the Carolinas. It's just people sort of lumped those in as one promotion because there was a lot of overlap of talent over the years. The geography here was such that it was relatively easy to rotate in and out talent. And, you know, because by the same token, though, because of how the South was then and even to some degree is now, and I say this as somebody who lives in the American South, like an area like you could probably, and this is partially speculation, but I think it's reasonable speculation based on what I know. This is not an area like the Northeast or even the Midwest, where you have a bunch of very large metropolitan areas dumped right on top of each other. You know, New York City, Philly, D.C., Baltimore, even Boston. I mean, these are all basically on one highway, I-95. You can hop on and off very easy. In the South, it's not necessarily that it was that it's hard to get to places in the sense that there were roads you could get to and fro, but I feel like because there were not these major markets, it was easier to slip back and forth from one promotion to another, even if you were a totally different character, or even if the fan base was totally different because the TV was totally different. Because the TV in Mobile or Alabama or Knoxville, Tennessee, or wherever, it's not a metropolitan area. It's not the same as New York and Philly. It's not the same. I mean, it's not just because of the size either. There's something innately different there. And I think what you see with somebody like Bob Armstrong is he can work, and did work different places. He had, I think, more value clearly in Southeastern than he ever did for Georgia Championship Wrestling. Yeah. And, there's probably a lot of reasons for that. But I think a lot of that just has to do with the way that the South was unique as a wrestling area. And I'm probably not even articulating that very well, but it was the combination of geography, infrastructure, the nature of local promotion in the South, I think was, I don't want to say it was way different than other places, but I do think it was unique.
Yeah, okay. It's very hard to assess, Stan Lane in 1981 is not Stan Lane from a few, even 2 years later, right? Robert Gibson the same. Dennis Condrey, I have no real concept of what Dennis Condrey was like pre-Midnights.
Condrey was a star. I mean, Condrey and Phil Hickerson were a big-time tag team.
They were big, right?
Yeah. I mean, Condrey was a meaningful star in the South and in Tennessee. And he would have been, not at the level of, somebody like JYD or anything crazy like that. But he absolutely would have been a meaningful addition. People would have known who he was, in other words.
Okay, and Norville Austin, who he formed the Midnights with?
Probably the same.
It's not looking too bad, is it? There are quite a few guys there who had some name value. Paul Orndorff, he was in and out as well, because he was mainly working for Watts. A lot of those guys, Atlas and Wrestling 2, they're in and out. It seems like the sort of place where people go where they need to do something else for a while, Let's think about a rating for it. Dylan, what's your rating?
I think it's very tough because this is one where I think trying to find the balance between, and it's even more complicated by the fact that I really don't know how strong or poor Southeastern business was in 81. But I'm going to go with a 5. And I could actually see an argument for higher. I'm sticking with a 5 only because we don't, and yes, we're working with a limited sample size, but there's not a lot of depth. We're making a judgment perhaps based on the best guys they've got, or the fact that this is just such a limited crew that this is only the guys they've got.
No, I went through, I think I'm pretty sure I went through the entire 81 run and pulled out the names and just left people who really seemed like they would, like guys I'd literally never seen or heard of before type thing, assuming they were local jobbers.
Sure. So this is probably pretty much it. Running with a relative skeleton crew in a lot of ways. I think there are guys who have very strong regional strengths. The Fallers, the Goldens, Armstrongs, Joe LeDuc really was a star in this region. So was the Stomper. And then there's a lot of guys who, and Ken Lucas too. I think, what's the word I'm looking for? They weren't quite there yet, okay?
Right, yeah.
Stan Lane, Robert Gibson, Brad Armstrong, who are probably, if you ask the average casual wrestling fan, those are probably the three names that would have the chance of meaning the most to them. you know, along with Orndorff Lane and Robert Gibson and Brad Armstrong, and those guys were nowhere near the peak of their stardom. So I'll go with a 5.
Kelly, what do you think?
Well, I wish I had our list of my rankings for the other territories.
You, I'm trying to think. Like, did you give anyone? I'm trying to think of the lowest rating that you gave Kelly has been something like a 5 so far. I think you gave. Didn't you give 5 to Portland?
That's what I was thinking. So, and I you know, I like Portland a lot.
And you gave 4 to Central States, I think, which is ridiculous.
No. I gave 2 to Central States.
Oh, 2 to Central States. Okay, good. All right.
My rating for world class was way high. Yeah, I've got a reputation to maintain. But, world class, I gave a 4, which was early on in the rankings when I hadn't yet really, you know, figured out.
You hadn't established the baseline. Yeah.
No, I hadn't, obviously. So 4, I can't. It's got to be more than a 4, because world class was pretty poor. 5 would be the same as Portland, right? I can't go any higher than 5. I don't think with this roster.
Okay.
And not having seen perhaps a second of this roster in 1981, I can't really give you too much.
I do want to mention here that I've always thought that this is exactly the sort of place that Randy Rose should have been working. Like, this is like the level of Randy Rose, I think. And I've always thought that Randy Rose in WCW is the most out of place guy ever. Like, if there was anybody made to be like a minor territories journeyman, it's him. So
No. Not that I necessarily disagree with that, but like Randy Rose to me, I remember thinking this as a kid. Okay, this sounds like something that I came up with after the fact, but I swear to God, it's not.
Right.
I remember thinking as a kid, and I'm talking about late '80s. You know.
Yeah.
Randy Rose should be tag team partners with Doug Summers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Randy Rose and Doug Summers should be a tag team. I remember in the late '80s, just being like a little geeky kid who would, you know, count the moves in the matches and do ridiculous stuff like that. And I remember thinking, I remember sort of innately, like, there was something about both guys that I liked in the sense that they both sort of felt like scummy wrestlers, but they didn't feel like stars either.
Yeah.
You know, so I remember these guys should be together. You know, in my mind, Randy Rose and Doug Summers are linked.
You're absolutely right. You know, 8-year-old Dylan was on the money there.
If the AWA would have lasted another couple of years, they probably would have had a run with the tag.
Oh, God, that would have been awesome. Can you imagine how, that would have been the sleaziest. The only way to make that better is if No Class Bobby Bass was their manager.
No, more controversially, and I know everybody in the world disagrees with me on this, but I think Robert Gibson is around that level as well on his own. Like, Robert Gibson without Ricky Morton, to me, is like even lower mid card on a roster like this.
I'm not going to rehash the Robert Gibson debate, but you know, because I actually don't have a really strong opinion on the subject, to be honest. But I will say one thing. I will say in defense of Robert Gibson. The few times he was, like, when he was asked to play a heel at the end of Smoky Mountain, both in the feud with the USWA and then, you know, in the angle where he was kind of left and joined Cornette's army in 95, I actually, like, I thought he was shockingly good at it. And that, to this day, has sort of always, I think, given me a slightly inflated view of Robert Gibson, because it was like, okay, this guy was able to do something that his reputation as the other guy who Ricky Morton tagged with, you wouldn't necessarily think would be able to do on paper. So I'm not a huge advocate of Robert Gibson either.
So factoring in all of these things, I think I'm going to give it a 4, which seems stingy, but I think it's a 4. And that is taking into account the fact that some of the bigger names there, Atlas, Wrestling 2, Johnny Valiant, even Orndorff, weren't really, really there for that long in 81. And the fact that, you know, like, I don't think, you know, my draft pick idea, let's give Jerry Jarrett the run of the green and see who he takes. I don't know how many guys he takes here. So, yeah, on that basis, it's a 4 from me. So let's move on, because in the Midwest, we have run by Dick the Bruiser, the WWA.
What a great promotion.
And this had been going for quite a while. Am I right in thinking it was kind of near death's door at this point?
Oh, yes.
It was, but I think it lasted until 89, actually.
Well, it remarkably. It lasted in some form into the later part of the 80s, but I don't know. I don't, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if you can even really compare it to what it was, because I'm not sure that's how true. Regular the loop was by that point.
No, its and, best days were way past them at this point.
So, I mean, Dylan, you know, you've researched AWA inside and out. Am I right? I mean, I've always thought of WWA as being kind of like a, like almost like a satellite territory for the AWA. Would that be to undersell it in any way or to oversell it?
I don't really think that's right. I understand why people think, why somebody would think that, because you see the name Dick the Bruiser, and you see, like, say, Wilbur Snyder, and you'd think, these are guys that I associate with the Midwest. These are guys that I associate with Midwestern wrestling. And then what's the other thing you associate with the Midwestern wrestling in the United States? Well, the AWA. So I can sort of see that. And they did run, basically they ran joint cards in Chicago. They would use a lot of WWA talent on the Chicago shows. Yeah. Joint cards is not really accurate. And I'm not even, you know, I think, was it Luce who was promoted? I can't even remember who it was. But, the point is, there is overlap in the sense that some of the same names will pop up here and there, depending on the era you're looking at. But the WWA was its own thing, you know. I mean, it really was, you know. And at its peak, it was a fairly vibrant promotion. I don't remember this. This tells you how great my research is for these shows, by the way. I don't remember the details of what sort of precipitated the fierceness of the decline with the WWA. I know that Bruiser tried to go head to head with the Sheik to basically take Detroit at one point.
Yeah, I hear that.
You know, so that was certainly an issue there. But to me, to the extent that you would call the WWA anything at this point, I think I would refer to them as the Central States to the St. Louis of AWA. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and that's kind of what I was getting at with the idea of a satellite.
Okay.
Almost like a kind of, because they recognize Vern as their champ as well, right? They recognize or Bockwinkel as the, I mean, do they ever? I think their world champion was the AWA champ, right? Is that right? Or do they have their? I know at one point maybe they had their own belt, but I'm pretty sure that they recognize the AWA champion as their champion.
I actually could not answer that question. I would suspect that is true. But at this point, I don't know that offhand. I can't remember. I don't offhand remember seeing any Bockwinkel title defenses in Indianapolis or any of those towns. But I also don't remember looking through very many
I mean,
dates
of
the WWA. So
they did. Yeah. I mean, they did bizarrely have their own world title too. I mean, for example, in 1981, the champion was Bobo Brazil.
Bobo Brazil in 1981. Wow, that's about the quality of those matches are about the level of 2012 Rock matches.
So let me run through the roster anyway. It's obviously Dick the Bruiser, Bobo Brazil at the age of 142, Wilbur Snyder, who was going up in years as well, Moose Cholak, who crops up on a lot of that Bob Luch stuff that I've seen, both in the ring and as a talking head, more hilariously. Ox Baker, Jerry Valiant, Johnny Valiant, Paul Christie, Roger Kirby. I believe those two were some sort of tag team. I can't remember their names. Bobby Colt, Pat Kelly, and Mike Kelly, who were twins, and they looked identical. I happen to know. Bald Eagle, El Broquero, Dutch Savage, Joe Cagle, Greg Lane, Bob Golden, The Black Saint, Mark Manson, Wally Watts, Johnny Starr, Jerry Graham Jr., Kelly, and the Russian Stomper, Igor Volkov, Pepper Gomez was there, Reverend Tiny Hampton. Was he a midget?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, this is a there's a guy called the Assassin, but not, you know,
not the one that matters.
Yeah. So I mean, that's basically who was working most of their card. I had pretty full data for this. They seemed to run quite a few shows, and you know, maybe even a few jobbers slipped through the net there. But yes. So Kelly, what did you make of this roster?
Well, firstly, going back to the affiliation with the AWA, according to the ever reliable Wikipedia, they did recognize the AWA champion in a general statement right at the beginning of the article. So,
right. Okay. Who knows?
Yeah. So no, and I think that's true. In 1981, still probably. I don't see why they wouldn't. Still recognize the AWA title that they had previously. But yeah, WWA, well, here we go, another area. I've seen, you know, a smattering of their glory days stuff from the 70s. There's some fun stuff with Heenan and Blackjack Lanza, both Blackjacks and Bruiser and, you know, Ernie Ladd and a whole bunch of guys. And the crowds were heated, and they actually, at their peak, they were a pretty respectable promotion and did well.
I think I'm right in thinking that though that stuff that you've seen, Kelly, is those jointly promoted Chicago shows.
Isn't it? Some of them were. I know some of them were definitely from Indianapolis. Like the announcer even was like, "We're from, you know, whatever arena it was in Indianapolis at the time." But,
right. Okay.
But yeah, and nonetheless, I mean, at that time, they were doing pretty well, I think. By 1981, well, if you look at the names, if Bobo Brazil is you know, contributing a lot to your promotion in 1981, then you're probably not doing too great. Wilbur Snyder must have been getting up there in years at that point. Moose Cholak, the same. the Valiants. Actually, the Valiants worked a lot in Indianapolis. I think that may have been where they started as a team.
I know as per my Titans bio, Kelly, Jerry Valiant was based there, and he ended when he worked for WF a couple of years later as a kind of jobber. It's because he owned a ring that they...
Right.
It was like he got a spot on the card in exchange for his actual ring. So there we go.
Yeah. So there's that. I mean, there's some interesting names. El Bracero is from maybe how you pronounce it. I'm not sure who that was.
Future Hall of Famer.
Definitely. Dutch Savage making sort of a rare... trip outside of the Pacific Northwest at this point, maybe. The Black Saint is a wonderful name. For sure. I'm going to research that one.
I'm sure that's a that's probably a racially sensitive gimmick for the era.
Oh, it's great. Igor Volkov was actually one half of the Yukon Lumberjacks tag team in the late 70s in the WWF that held the strap.
Really? Really?
Yeah, not Scott Irwin, the other guy in that team. I'm Pierre and Eric or something. I forget what their names were. And he was wrestling in Portland around this time, too, or just slightly earlier, as Igor Volkov. Let's see. Yes. Well, Jerry Graham Jr. I don't know. I think there was probably various Jerry Graham Jr.'s, and we've encountered them already. And so, yeah, not a big time star. Greg Wojciechowski ends up, or maybe even by this time, I know he ends up, anyways, the top star in the territory for much of the 80s, the great Wojo.
He's the Mike George. He's the Mike George of WWE.
Yeah, the king of a dead territory. Not exactly a great distinction to have. Yeah, this is a roster of a lot of old guys and journeymen and guys that are, you know, up and comers but would never end up going anywhere. Yeah.
Does anything say outlaw more than having Ox Baker on the roster?
that would be up there. That would certainly be near the top of outlaw. Maybe the Reverend Tiny Hampton or the Black Saint, who I'm now theorizing was actually a African-born priest, liberation theologist. He was like a Oscar Romario follower, that's what I'm going with. Of course, there's zero chance that's true, but we're going to go with that anyway. So, this roster sucks, by the way.
Any deeper thoughts on that, Dylan?
I know you could make an argument for Central States, and you can maybe make an argument for some of the stuff that's to come. I think this is actually definitively the worst roster we're going to cover. I say that even though I haven't gone back and looked at this stuff very, very, very closely in the last, little bit here, but I really think this is definitively the worst roster. And I shouldn't say that. There may be one in Canada worse, but we'll get to that eventually. But what's notably bad about this is, in my opinion, look at this roster. The guys they have that are stars are all ancient. Okay, they're all, none of them are particularly good work. I mean, Wilbur Snyder was said to be a very good worker in his day, to be fair, but this was not his day.
When was his day, Dylan? Like the 1940s, 1950s?
Not that far back. 50s, 60s, yeah. Late 50s, I think, is when my timeline could be off. I haven't looked at the record book in a while, but so you're this is not. There's not even guys like with some of these other rosters we've talked about. We could identify somebody working underneath who maybe wasn't a star yet, but they would eventually become one, right? Look at this roster. Who on this roster becomes a meaningful player in wrestling that wasn't already one and at the back end of their career in 1981?
Really, no one.
No one.
Really isn't anyone.
I mean, who? Spike Huber? I mean, Christ. I would argue this is the kind of roster that kills promotions. Like we could talk about, you could say that Dick the Bruiser and Bobo and even Wilbur, although he was never really booked as an on top guy in WWA, which is one of the big criticisms of him when it comes to Hall of Fame season again. But you could argue that those guys are Hall of Fame level guys. I mean, certainly Bobo and Dick the Bruiser are, and I think Wilbur's got a pretty good case, but they were so far into the twilight of their careers. And not only that, they weren't the kind of veterans that could carry new talent or cultivate new talent. You know what I mean? We're not talking about somebody who could go in. This isn't Jack Briscoe here. You know, whatever you think of Jack Briscoe's working style, these are guys who they might be able to give you 7 or 8 minutes, and it wasn't going to be a particularly good 7 or 8 minutes. To me, this is the dirt worst. I'll go ahead and throw out my ranking. I think this is a one. I think this is a one, and it's very close to a zero. The only reason I give it any points at all is because there are a couple of names that could still reasonably be expected to draw houses in that area. But in terms of a promote, I mean, there's nothing in this promotion that is suitable to be built around in 1981. Absolutely nothing.
No, and I just checked. Bobo Brazil was 57 in
Christ.
I mean, 57 years old.
And I mean, look, God bless Bobo. I'm not taking a shot on the guy. This was not a guy who was considered a good worker at his, you know, athletic peak. So think about that.
And he was their champion in 81 as well. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he had to be. Look who else they've got. I mean, they had no choice. I mean, as sad as that sounds, a 57-year-old Bobo Brazil was the best option.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, it is dire. There's nothing else to it. I mean, like the Kelly twins, you look at those two and you think, well, what would they do? They were basically like guys who would be, they would be like guys in the world title picture type thing. You take those two guys and you put them in any other promotion and they're basically what? Jobbers, like one step up from the Malkies, basically, you know? I can't see any other promotion giving those guys a run. Or even like a second look, you know. Kelly, one out of 10, fair?
Yeah, I had to go back and check Central States quickly because that's my low territory so far. I gave them a 2. And yeah, actually, it makes Central States look not too bad.
I think Central States is considerably better.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Considerably better.
I mean... No,
okay, I mean, they got Harley. At least he can work.
Oh, they got Art Cruz.
Yeah, Butch Reed was there. I mean, yeah, so I at mean, least they had the young point. Star.
Yeah, yeah, there's at least they had a young you up could theoretically see them building around. I mean, there's nobody in WWE.
No, it's dire. It's a 1. Yeah, it's a 1 for sure.
I like Jerry Valiant.
You were good in 79.
That might be the shittiest devil's advocate argument I've ever heard.
I can't even imagine, like, can you imagine, like, Moose Cholak versus, like, Bobby Colt? It's just, like, so dire, isn't it? Okay, yeah, 1. This is bad. There's no 2 ways around it.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and join us next time when we will be looking at truly the last dregs of U.S., territories from 1981, including the ICW promotion, a true outlaw promotion run by Angelo Poffo, and Mike LaBelle's LA promotion, which it's fair to say was on its ass.
Extra, extra, the last of the Titans, the last of the Titans, the last of the Titans, extra, extra, read all about it. Extra, the last of the Titans.